Good afternoon, Leonard. It's nice to see you again today. My name, as you know, is Jim Balter, and this is my partner, Gene Simon. We are here to interview you for the oral history collection of the Pittsburgh Section National Council of Jewish Women. Today is Friday, November 30th, 1990. Would you be good enough to tell us your name and birthday?
My name is Leonard Weitzman, W-E-I-T-Z-M-A-N, born May 4th, 1923.
Yesterday, Leonard, you started to tell us a bit about how you started VRC and the different locations you looked at and the Duquesne University plan where you found the empty lot. Would you like to go and tell us, continue that same?
Fine. When I knew that the future of the organization depended upon a better physical plant, I set about trying to find the proper location. I remember very vividly taking a map of downtown Pittsburgh and drawing a couple of lines, which was a square. The bottom part of the square was the point formed by the two rivers, and the two top lines were about a mile or two up, which sort of encompassed what we'd call the downtown area of Pittsburgh. Because I knew it had to be centrally located and it had to have good accessibility. And just by circumstance, I found this piece of property on Forbes Avenue, which was part of the URA, Urban Redevelopment Authority, what they referred to as the Bluff Street Project. I think there was a presumption by somebody that this property had been acquired and the buildings raised with the idea of the acquisition by Duquesne University to expand their campus. But for reasons that I'm not aware of and nobody could explain to me, Duquesne did not seem to be interested in crossing Forbes Avenue. Therefore, the property was available. And even though the URA, once they were aware of the fact that Duquesne wasn't going to acquire it, was interested in having it diverted for commercial purposes, whereby it would be revenue-producing in terms of taxes and contributing to the productivity of Pittsburgh. I convinced Johnny Morrow and the URA that it would be to our best interest to acquire that property and put up our institution. And as it turned out, we did acquire the land at a reasonable price. And once we had the land, I was able to, through a combination of federal money and contributed money that was going out to the community and getting contributions from corporations, foundations, and individuals, was able to put together a financing plan that would enable us to put up what I called phase one of the building. Phase one was the first floor, which was a walk-in floor from Forbes Avenue, and a lower floor, which was made possible by the grading of the ground sloping towards the rear. This building, which was considered to be very ambitious by many people, including many of our board members, who wondered how our small number of secretaries and staff were going to occupy this large space. There was a considerable trepidation on everybody's part that we could get the financing not only to make the building fly, but then to generate the operating income after it was in operation to keep the plant going. Well, I think that they say history is prologue, and as a result of that, we did get the financing, much to everybody's surprise, and we didn't have an outsized fundraiser. The fundraisers, particularly Mr. Ketchum and company, turned us down, said we were a bad risk, we couldn't raise the money. I went out and I raised the money that was required to put the building up, both the combination of the federal monies and the contributed money. And as a matter of fact, when the final results were tabulated, we were oversubscribed, that is, we had more than enough money to cover all the costs of the building. As it turned out, those who had concerns about the building being too large, including one notable board member whose name I won't mention, in a matter of a couple of years, we found out that the building was actually too small for us. We were growing at such a rapid rate that when I built the building originally, I had designed for 4 additional floors expansion, so that we built in the elevator capacity and all the mechanicals and so forth and so on. In a matter of a couple of years, we were already planning for the 2-story expansion. And again, I went out to the community and to public funds and got the additional money that was necessary to affect the expansion. This one board member, by the way, who resigned from the board, thinking that it was an overly optimistic projection, I bumped into him one day and he apologized to me and said, "I have to tell you that I was absolutely wrong." He said, "There was a need for this building. You had better foresight than I did." And probably better for the record to his name, because he's a well-known person, not be recognized. But in any event, the building not only was completed successfully financially, but we generated enough funds over the years to... our staff, by the way, through a federal staffing grant, tripled in the first 3 years. We went from 30 staff to 90 staff, and at the height of our activity, we were up to 167 staff. We went from a budget. When I first joined the organization in 1947, we had a combined budget of $30,000. And at the height of our level, we were at a budget in excess of $7 million. So the organization, I think, had shown that there was a need for this kind of organization, and that there was the resources available to make it operate successfully.
Ron, if you brought two questions to mind, that's a very interesting story you just told us. When you said you raised money from individuals and community, did you have in mind particularly the Jewish community or more the general community?
Well, actually, it was a combination of both. We went to the established foundations, but we also went to some of the Jewish foundations that I had known over the years who knew us. And since I had very... well-maintained contacts with the Jewish community from our former sectarian bases and from people who we kept maintained
servicing
in terms of communication and so forth and so on. We found that many of these people were receptive. So I would say from the individual point of view, and individuals as they represented their own companies, I would say that the Jewish base for the private effort, if you take away the foundations, I think was substantial. I think the Jewish, and if you look at the plaque on the wall that commemorates the contributors, I think you'll go down there and you'll see a lot of Jewish names. Right. So there was always, I think, Jews are known to be supporters of good causes, and this is no exception.
For the record, Leonard, the general community thinks highly of and everyone thinks what a wonderful organization BRC is. Mm-hmm. But I don't think they know specifically the type of client base you served and the activities. For example, you mentioned that you raised enough money through your operating funds rather than contributions to keep your annual operating expenses.
Right.
Could you tell us what kind of function you did? And well, if you will, to your input into it.
Well, I tried to replicate the operating budget similar to, I guess the analogy is a hospital. When people go to a hospital, generally somebody pays for that service, either an insurance company, which would represent either Blue Cross, Blue Shield, or a private insurance carrier, a public agency such as Medicare, Medicaid, or the individual might pay themselves. Now, the number of individual payers has dropped down because hospital care became so expensive. But using that as a model, I then went out and began to package our services in such a way that I would begin to attract the insurance companies and also the private, the public sector, such as state agencies, county agencies, by selling them services that they were required to provide to the citizens.
Such as
the State Office of Vocational Rehabilitation, which became a very important part of our financing structure, the Allegheny County Mental Health and Mental Retardation Program, the Office for the Blind. Those are the kinds of agencies that, public agencies, that we sold them services on a fee-for-service basis.
Now, what type of service, for example, in the mental retardation?
Well, one of the things, you know, our agency has always maintained as its objective the evaluation of the vocational potential of physically and mentally handicapped people. And then, once that assessment was made, to prepare these people to so they could assume those responsibilities in the regular work world. And so those are services that these public agencies are mandated by both federal and state law to provide to disabled people. Now the question is, who's going to provide it? So that I was there with a whole range of services, and they bought these services for me. And their objective and our objective was to take these people who were really many of them on the public dole, which means that public assistance and Social Security income and other kinds of support services were supporting. The idea was to take these people and to turn them into independent producers, so that they were not only off the public dole, but they were now becoming a tax-paying citizen, which is a double-edged sword, so that you relieve the pressure on one end, and you make them a contributing member of society on the other end. So that was the model. I mean, again, using the hospital analogy, hospitals try to make people well. Well, we were trying to get people who were in some way sick, not contributors to society, and turn them around so they became well and became out and could function in the everyday work world.
And now you've done a wonderful... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
And so I think that... you know, I think any organization feeds upon its own success, whether it's a private industry or a so-called non-private or Elliot Mosslery organization. And when you are successful, then you attract more and more customers, which were all these paying agencies, including insurance companies. Insurance companies, particularly the area of workers' comp, long-term disability, where employers were paying premiums to these insurance companies, and insurance companies, by paying out these all these benefits, you know, were getting the money back from the employers. Therefore, it was to everybody's advantage to get people who were injured at work, getting them off that workers' compensation dole, and again, getting them back to work. So we began to market that to insurance companies, and... even to some private companies. We had some private companies who came to us because they felt that their insurance company wasn't doing the right kind of job for them. And so we sold some, whoever would pay us to take these disabled people and turn them into workers, that was the policy we pursued.
And you had training programs for physically disabled, mentally disabled,
everybody,
visually impaired, whatever.
I think the thing that most people don't understand, and I used to use this a great deal when I went out and gave my public speeches, is that for a variety of reasons, the number of disabled people in our population is increasing. First of all, let's take the newborns.
Mm-hmm.
because of the advances in medical sciences, a lot of children are born genetically defective or developmentally disabled who died previously during the birth process. Now we have a lot of people with all kinds of neurological and developmental deficits who are now surviving. And you read about them all day in Children's Hospital, for example, when you get these young kids who are coming from transplantation surgery. Years ago, they didn't reach that age. They died earlier. They died in childbirth. So there was a population all of a sudden that was exploding. Secondly, we had people who had disease entities that when I first came in the field, we never saw adults. Myasthenia gravis, cystic fibrosis. When they reached 13, 14, 15 years of age, they died. Now, through a variety of therapies and drugs, they're living to adults. And what do we do with these people? Do we just warehouse them, or do we try to get them out in the society? Developmentally disabled. When I started in this field, I never heard the term. The kid was either dumb if he didn't learn. We weren't perceptive enough and didn't have enough diagnostic skills in the school system to know the kids weren't learning because they had something wrong. A notable exception is Nelson Rockefeller. He was dyslexic. When he read, his words were reversed. Now, if he wasn't a Rockefeller, they might think he was a slow kid. But they had the resources to diagnose it and to put into a system, into effect, that made Nelson Rockefeller what he was. So that's another group. We also had, in the last dozen years, what we call traumatically brain injured. Particularly a lot of young people who are in automobile accidents or sports accidents or whatever, who got brain injured. Now, we know that physiologically, the brain is the only organ in your body that doesn't regenerate itself. You may have a cut or you may have problems in some organ where you'll get regeneration of tissue, not the brain. When you have brain injury, it's dead. That part that's scarred is dead. Well, the question is, what do you do with these people? Well, first of all, people with brain injuries, when they went in comatose, normally didn't come out. They usually died because we didn't have the life support systems. Now, all of a sudden, we've got young people waking up after 5, 6, 8, 9, 10 months, and they get better. Also, the fact that they have neurological deficits because of brain injury, we're able to re-educate different parts of the brain called cognitive retraining. So other parts of the brain can take over to perform the functions. So that, again, that's another population that exploded into this world. There's another phenomenon that took place at that time. People began to become aware, primarily through, I think, parents' organizations, that a lot of people who were warehoused in institutions, both the mentally retarded and the mentally ill, that they were put there to die for lots of reasons. And all of a sudden we realized that, number one, it was not the humane thing to do. These people did have potential to live in the community. And secondly, it was not cost-effective. I mean, the rates for storing people like that became astronomically high. And the question is, are we going to keep, as taxpayers, absorbing that cost? Obviously, it goes back to the basic philosophy of what VRC was started for. And that is to take people who are non-producing and who are getting on public support to turn them into independent tax-paying people. So the same philosophy transcends through this whole line. It's just that there's changing times and changing populations and changing philosophies out there brought this into a sharper focus.
You mentioned about warehousing people. I understand you were quite, in fact, you were the leading force behind the idea of going out in the community and having companies give you work to do for your people.
Well, one of the things that when I mentioned earlier on that I was I first started at VRC, we had a little workshop, and I did that initially part time, then took it over full time. Is that one of the philosophies we had is the best way to take people and transition them into good workers is to give them the opportunity of working on real live work and paying them. For some people who thought they could never do anything productively, and the fact is they're doing something that's going out into the world marketplace, and they are getting paid not as a the guest of a county or a state, but they're getting paid because they earned it, because they produced something. Psychologically, it does something to people to know that they can be valuable. So we did that. We went out and got work, and I don't think that I really invented it, because that started around the turn of the century. But I took that concept and began to develop it to the point where our workshop became a very important force in the commerce world, while it was serving as a useful vehicle for transitioning disabled people and preparing them for the real live world.
Mm. Well, you didn't start the concept, but you certainly expanded it.
Well, I like to think I had some role.
What did you do with the unemployable?
Well, some people became unemployable for a number of reasons. I think I can say with pride, our agency pioneered with the work of the mentally ill. We worked with Western Psych, and I developed some relationships with Western Psychiatric Institute. But when you work with a population like that, it's a population at risk. And in those days, we didn't have the tools. That is, we didn't have the drugs and the medications and the knowledge to help people. So we had regressions. We had people who they thought were getting better, and all of a sudden they'd relapse. Or people who were physically, we worked with a high-risk population. So we thought somebody was getting better, and all of a sudden they got worse. So when we talked about unemployables, a lot of times they were unemployable because they had relapses in their own condition. For those people who could not make it into the regular work world, we tried to keep in our workshop a number of slots so that people at their own pace, at their own capabilities, would have a place to come to and work irrespective of their productive level. So we had people that I would say produced almost at a 10% of normal level. But that's the best they could do, and for that, they know they had a purpose in life and a place to come. And I think it also served as a social reinforcement for them.
Okay. Tell us a bit, if you would. Leonard, you're probably too modest to put it on the tape, but we happen to know that you were president of the International Vocational Rehabilitation Group. Would you like to talk about that for a bit?
Well, I have always been one who felt that there need to be professional organizations to have the sharing of ideas and things like that. And some of the things that I'm very proud of is, number one, I am one of the few people around today who was on the original committee that brought into play a National Commission on Standards for Rehabilitation Facilities. And that organization, the Commission on Accreditation of Rehabilitation Facilities, which is now located in Tucson, Arizona, is one of the leading national certification agencies. And I consider myself the kind of the midwife for that organization. Then I became the national president of an organization called the National Association of Sheltered Workshops and Homebound Programs. In 1967, 1969. In 1969, that organization merged with another organization called the Conference of Rehabilitation Facilities. And that merger produced a new organization called the National Association of Rehabilitation Facilities, which encompassed all of the educational, medical, vocational rehabilitation facilities in the United States. And I facilitated that merger. And in 1975, I became the national president of that organization. And I still serve, by changing the bylaws, on the Council of Presidents of that organization. And I go to their annual meetings and quarterly meetings. Participate. I also became a delegate to an international organization which was part of an organization called Rehabilitation International, which was broken down into six commissions. One of the commissions was a vocational commission, and I was a delegate. I was appointed a delegate to that commission. And then I forget the year it was, but the chairman of that commission, who was a Dane, had a heart attack and died in the middle of his tenure. And I received a call from the president from Australia asking me if I would take over the chairmanship of that commission, which I did for 2 years. At the end of that period of time, I was elected by the commission members to serve another four-year term on my own. I think I was one of the few Americans that was been selected to head up a national commission. I had 69 countries under my aegis, and was necessitated a trip at least twice a year to some foreign land where we were treated with my wife and I were treated with much pomp and circumstance. Europeans and Asians are not alike Americans. Americans treat chairmen and presidents with almost disdain. Europeans and Orientals, Asians, somehow when you're the chairman, you are Mr. Chairman, and they extend to you all the courtesy of that office. So we don't have enough time, but except to tell you that we were the guests of a number of countries, probably the most interesting one for the National Council would be the fact that we were the guests of the East German government, which was proud of what they were doing in the area of rehabilitation, which wasn't very much, but nevertheless, they invited my wife and I, the leader guests, to come to their country and to show us what they were doing with disabled people. But anyway, we had six glorious years as in that position.
Tell us the lost briefcase story.
Okay, well, I don't know how you found out, but this is to me was a fascinating experience. My wife and I were in Vienna, and we were scheduled to go to Budapest because I had some members of my commission who were from Hungary, and they had invited me, my wife, to come to Budapest as her guest. So we got on in the train station. Well, on our way to the train station in Vienna, my wife wanted to buy some liqueur that our Australian friends told us we needed to buy, we should have. So we ran to the liquor store on the way to the train station, bought it, and with all of our belongings and trying to catch the train, the strap on the shoulder bag broke and hit the platform, and this liqueur was splattered all over the train station and over our camera and everything else. And in order to make the train, we were gathering up all of our belongings and trying to get the goo off all of our stuff. And we got on the train. I got on the train, and when we were walking on the train, our feet were sticking to the platform. We could hear the sticky noise. We finally got a seat, and we were finally relaxed. And the train had pulled out on the way to Budapest. Well, I decided that I should review my notes because I just conducted this international meeting, and I wanted to. I never take notes during a meeting, but I recapture it. I start do my minutes afterwards. I looked around and I could not find my black briefcase with all of my international material in it. And I said, "My goodness, where is it? It must be somewhere in the train station." Well, we got to the border of I guess Austria and Hungary. And there was a train that was going the other direction towards Vienna. And there was a woman in this little compartment who saw I was very upset and couldn't understand why I was upset. And she didn't speak English, but I was trying to convey to her my black bag was missing. When we got to this station, she yelled at the conductor and began to convey to him, "Schwarz." I heard Schwarz was in black back. And I said, "Well, that's going to be the end of that." We got to Hungary and to Budapest, and we checked into our hotel, and I told the reception desk about the fact that I dropped my briefcase in Vienna's train station and so forth and so on, figuring I'd never see it again. Well, that night at dinner at the hotel, my wife and I, all of a sudden, somebody from the desk walks in, and she, I didn't see what she had in her hands, she had behind her back, came to our table, and behold, brought our black briefcase, which had, I had no name on it, I had nothing on it, I have no idea how the conductor from the train going to Vienna, how they found the suitcase. They put it on a train, going to Budapest, gave it to the police. My hotel called the police, found out the black bag was there, sent a taxi cab down to the police station and brought me my bag. So,
isn't that interesting?
So, and you have to remember now, Austria being a Western country and Hungary being an Eastern country, and that, you know, I thought that was a miracle.
Sure is.